Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you along with us today. Professor Anthony Cordesman is the holder of the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and is currently a national security analyst for ABC News. His analysis has been featured prominently during the Gulf War, during Desert Fox, the conflict in Kosovo, the fighting in Afghanistan, and the Iraq War. Following the testimony last week by Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus and a conditions-based strategy for staying in Iraq, Anthony Cordesman wrote, "I believe there is still a case for staying in Iraq, but I also believe that Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus decisively failed to make it. My sympathy lies with the senators and congressmen who tried for hours to get some hint of a clear plan or strategy for the future and got nothing but conditions-based statements of uncertainty. In saying this, I do not blame Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus. It is not their function to develop a clear strategy and set of conditions for staying in Iraq. It is the responsibility of the president, and this president seems incapable of that kind of leadership." It's a pleasure to have you with us today, Anthony Cordesman.
Good morning.
Thanks for spending time with us. You have a definite conflict with the president over the future of our military forces in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I don't know if I have a conflict, but I think when you talk about the future, one of the problems we have is we have no plan for the future. We have no budget, even for the present. Money is something that people often forget in the press because policy is much more interesting. But at this point in time, the Congress failed to fund this year's budget request, which has never been explained in detail.
Mm-hmm.
And when the president put forward the budget that he is asking the Congress to approve this fall, the defense budget did not basically cover the cost of any of the wars, and it was stated that there would be a $70 billion request for supplementals. When Secretary Gates was pressed to explain that, he said that basically he was not ready to do it, and that the real cost might actually be $170 to $185 billion. So we're going, in fact, we're in the middle of two wars, and we don't even have a working budget request for this year.
You have written that you believe that the United States has to set out a plan. Talk about this plan, what it might entail.
Well, I think we have to set conditions as well as a plan. One of the problems that became very clear in the hearing, for example, is we've never properly defined the conditions for building Iraqi forces that can replace us. When you go to Iraq and you talk to the U.S. military advisory teams, it becomes obvious it's going to take several years to complete a force. People talked in Congress about why can't they fight, why aren't they ready? Well, the reasons are fairly obvious. We had no plan to create them when we went to war. We didn't really have a workable plan to train them till 2005. We still haven't provided a lot of the equipment that we're persuading them to buy. The force keeps expanding. We only provided adequate embedded trainers during the course of last year, and that's only for the Army and regular forces. We've essentially had to give up on the year of the police. Now, there is real progress among some elements of the Iraqi forces. But if we're going to build on that progress to keep reducing U.S. troops, we can't keep telling the Congress things that simply aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true of the economy. When you look at the reporting, the Congress talked about the cost of the USAID program. Well, there are reports by what's called the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. That's part of the State Department, and they show, yes, we've spent an immense amount on aid. We also spent some $30 billion worth of Iraqi money on our planning. But we had no plan, no capability to staff an aid effort when we invaded Iraq. Now, basically, we've already stopped funding most of the aid. And we have no transition plan to go from our money to what has to be Iraqi spending, and we did not successfully create an Iraqi capability to manage and govern the budget they have, but we did destroy the old system as part of our advisory effort. Now, there is, with Iraq's oil wealth, the ability to sharply reduce any kind of future U.S. aid expenditure. But there's no plan, at least public plan, to do it. Those cover two critical elements of reducing U.S. exposure, casualties, the troop levels, the costs in Iraq. The other area is we can't determine Iraq's political future, and it probably isn't going to be a model democracy. But our mistakes created a situation where Iraq had no local and provincial elections, and where Iraqis had to vote the last time in national elections for closed nationwide lists of people most Iraqis had never heard of, and as a result they voted along ethnic and sectarian lines. We can clearly set forward plans for more representative government and more effective patterns of governance.
The Iraqis have provincial and local elections coming at the end of this year. Will those elections be in the kind of closed model that you just mentioned, or is it open to a greater number of candidates?
Well, the fact is we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. The planning is October. Now, Iraq doesn't have classic political parties, particularly at the local levels. The Shiite parties that do exist, aside from Sadr's party, which is sort of a party of people at the populist level with low incomes and more religious groups, are essentially exile parties that have power at the national level, but really have not had to campaign or organize at the state and local level. The Sunni parties that emerged in the last election had no broad power base. The Kurds are in a much better situation. But the problem is we don't know whether the elections will really be held on time. There are no clear plans for how the elections will be held. Parties have to emerge between now and October if they're held on schedule. And UN supervision has to occur, or whatever the law may be, in a country dominated by power struggles and corruption, local and provincial elections can take on a very unpleasant cast.
We're talking with Anthony Cordesman, who is the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, as we talk about Iraq and Afghanistan and other events. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. And our email address, if you'd like to do it that way, is talk@wpr.org. Anthony Cordesman, let's take some calls. We'll start with Mike in Appleton. Hello, Mike. What's on your mind today?
Yes. Good morning, Professor. Good morning. Yeah, I agree with you, Professor. The planning, well, the lack of planning has been absolutely disastrous. And I'm afraid we've placed our military leaders in an impossible situation to come up with answers that our leadership hasn't provided. But looking forward, I wonder if you agree with me in the following, that unfortunately, I think our presence, not in Iraq, but our presence in the region is vital. And obviously because of we have to be there to be able to control the flow of oil, to guarantee the flow of oil. How do you see the situation developing with regards to Iran? How do you see that playing itself out?
Well, it's a very good question, and one where we have to recognize that Iran is not a country that's going to be easy to talk to. It's going through its own internal political struggles, and so far those struggles have strongly benefited very hardline political figures inside Iran. It is, seems very doubtful, although we should continue to try, that diplomacy is going to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons or the missiles to deliver them. And unfortunately, a lot of the debate of this ignores the delivery systems. So I think that first, we do need to continue to focus on Iran. It would be extremely dangerous to have a power vacuum in Iraq because the Shiites in Iraq would virtually have to turn to Iran. And they become linked almost inevitably to Syria, to the Shiite Hezbollah inside Lebanon. We also, regardless of what we do, have to improve our relations with the southern Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, the other Arab states, the states where we are reliant on bases, not simply for Iraq, but almost all of the airlift and a good part of the air operations in Afghanistan are based out of Kuwait and Qatar. This type of issue is something we can't ignore. We have to have a stable presence whether we stay in Iraq or not. If we can stay in Iraq and create a buffer to Iran, that's one solution. Another is to help our Gulf allies create a better deterrent to Iran and help contain it. But we're going to have to be there because there is no alternative power, and as you point out, you still have about 60% of the world's proven oil reserves and 40% of its proven gas reserves in that small area.
Yeah, Professor, if I could, one additional question.
Yes.
Okay, so we have to be there. There is no choice. And in spite of what all of the politicians say, I think when whoever comes into the presidential office will come to that realization, if they don't know it already. My big question here is, it seems inevitable that Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon. And I really don't think the Israelis are going to allow that to happen. How do you see that playing out?
The practical problem is that it is possible at this point, and it will be in the future, to probably have a series of U.S. strikes that could destroy Iran's capability to have a working nuclear force. But that's a massive campaign. It isn't just one set of air raids against today's nuclear facilities. The problem is that Iran has already developed a considerable and well-dispersed base for building long-range missiles. It's just announced that it has 6,000 much more advanced centrifuges in production. Even if the Israelis took out the two major underground facilities Iran is using to create the capability to produce nuclear weapons materials at this point, it could disperse effective centrifuges in a whole new set of facilities afterwards, and they'd be the more advanced centrifuges. And Israel might get one raid against some key targets in Iran, but it couldn't destroy the technology base. It would have an impact, but it wouldn't be like a Sirac was. It would have a very limited impact, perhaps for a couple of years.
Thank you very much, Mike, for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Thanks very much. Let's move on to Stephen in Madison. Stephen, go ahead.
You know, Mr. Cordesman, doesn't it seem a bitter shame that here we are some 60 years after the horrors of World War II, and now we have the United States and the Israeli and British militaries fomenting chaos and bombing all over the world. It seems like we're going to repeat the horrors of the 40s. But I want to ask you specifically, when you look back and see, and analyze how the explosions that pulverized the World Trade Towers were set by deliberate demolition charges, and then you review how that the so-called war on terror is a pretext for invading the oil lands, built on the inside job that was 9/11. How can anybody dispute that those skyscrapers were not pulverized by planted demolition charges? So I believe the entire U.S. empire, which, by the way, is going to go down, which is crumbling because of financial overreach, I think that, and Mr. Cordesman, you seem to be an honest man, even though you're a CIA Department of Defense guy. I wish you would analyze truthfully what really happened on 9/11 and how has it served the empire as a pretext. Thank you, sir.
Well, look, we all have our conspiracy theories, but there is an immense record of what happened when the aircraft hit the two towers. It's quite clear there weren't demolition charges. It's equally clear that the various conspiracy theories that somehow American Jews weren't present in the building were absurd. None of this has been confirmed by any investigation. The tragedy is those aircraft did destroy the Twin Towers. And speaking personally, having watched an aircraft go into the side of the Pentagon, which is about a mile from my home, and having smelled the electrical fires for several days and watched people cope with this, these aren't something which were made up by outsiders. And it was quite clear who flew those aircraft. It was quite clear they were people sponsored by Al-Qaeda. We need to say that whatever mistakes we've made, we're dealing with a very real set of problems. And there are very real threats. And the United States can't pretend that it can simply withdraw from the world and that any of this is going to go away.
We're talking with Anthony Cordesman, who is the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, who, by the way, will be back with us tomorrow, and she will be leading the program at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, so we're happy to have her back. We're continuing to talk with Anthony Cordesman, who is the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. If you'd like to join the conversation, there's a line open in Madison. The number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our next caller is Ed in Hanover. Ed, what's on your mind this morning?
Good morning. It's Ed from Conover, up in northern Wisconsin.
All right.
I'm just wondering, you know, all the aid or call it whatever you would like to Iraq, and the price of our oil in this country. Why can't we just buy oil from Iraq? I know it might throw the world into a turmoil, but that would kill two birds with one stone, wouldn't it?
Well, we need to understand something about where we Iraq really is. It has massive oil reserves, but at this point it produces only about 2.5 million barrels a day, and it can export about 1.9. We pay the same price for Iraqi oil we pay for oil from anyone else. And the problem we face is we're competing with massive increases in demands from China and from Asia. As the world develops in general outside the West, you get a massive increase in demand for oil, and for that matter, for gas. And that's putting pressure on the price structure. Whether the price structure should be anything like today's level is a matter of debate, but it isn't a matter of what's happened in terms of the Iraq War. Iraqi oil exports and oil production are just about today what they were before we invaded. The difficulty is that whatever happens with Iraq, it will be years before they get up even to the 5 million barrels a day level. And at least for half a decade, we probably face a major problem because we have to pay the same price for oil as anybody else, whether or not we're in Iraq. Iraq also faces a problem most Americans don't understand. It can't refine the oil it has. It has to basically export oil and then import product from other countries. That gas and heating oil is just as expensive for Iraqis as it is for Americans. In some cases more so because it has to be moved through what are often combat or unstable areas. So it would be nice if Iraq was able to export anything like the amount of oil its resources will someday allow it to export. At this point, it is too small an exporter to have that much impact.
What do you think of the notion that being floated around to use the money that Iraq is accumulating for selling oil to help pay for operations in Iraq by military forces?
I think the problem we face is that when we talk about paying for U.S. military forces, that is something where Iraq's money at most can cover its current expenditures, building up the Iraqi forces we want to replace our forces, dealing with the problems of development and political stability which create the political accommodation we want. We're not talking about a country which is that wealthy in practical terms. It is a country which is not yet able to effectively spend the money it has, partly because of its own internal problems and partly because when the U.S. went in, it attempted to create an aid system to restructure the way that Iraqis manage their budgets. Our plans didn't work, the aid effort failed, and we helped create a mess that the Iraqis face. But I think the goal here is not to have sort of short-term money go from Iraq to spend for today's U.S. troops. It is to totally replace U.S. economic aid and to fund the kind of Iraqi forces that can replace U.S. military forces.
Thanks very much, Ed, for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Tom is next in Green Bay. And, Tom, what's on your mind this morning?
Good morning. And, Mr. Cordesman, the next time someone calls you and comes up with this conspiracy theory about blowing up the buildings and everything in New York, ask them if they've read the book Debunking the 9/11 Myths by Popular Mechanics, I do believe it was. I got it for Christmas. And it was easy to read, and if it's easy for me to read, if those people can read, they should be able to understand it. And I think it was just on television again the other night, that series they have on that, I think on Discovery or History, one of those two. But anyhow, I just want to let you know about that, and I agree with pretty much everything else you're saying here, except for those wacko folks that call you up.
Are you familiar with the book that he's referencing?
No, I haven't read that book, and I think it's good to have one out that can deal with this at a popular level. I think it's also important to note that what there are literally thousands of pages of detailed examination of what happened with the building, why the special design features of the two towers made them extremely vulnerable, why there were design problems in the core of the building that made them much more unstable than the average high-rise. These are issues which have led to a lot of redesign of how we're going to build high-rise buildings in the future. So there really was a set of problems that no one knew about when the aircraft hit the World Trade Center. Otherwise, there would have been a much more limited impact than the impact that occurred.
Tom, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. We go next to Daniel in Rice Lake. Daniel, what can we do for you?
Hello. I have heard the Mahdi Army, the Mahdi Army, has something like 70 to 80,000 full-time troops and over 200,000 part-time and millions of supporters. Is that a realistic assessment of Muqtada al-Sadr's military strength?
What you have are core cadres of a force that isn't disciplined or organized. What you saw was people basically create local militias and almost local gangs. Now, Sadr had spent almost the last year trying to bring what's called the Mahdi Army under some degree of control. The cadres are really probably, as a total, under 10,000. Virtually every Iraqi is armed, so when you talk about part-time fighters, the truth is it's impossible to know what would happen if you suddenly had a major fight between the Sadrists and the other two Shiite parties in the south. But we've never seen in the greater Baghdad area anything like the organized strength you're talking about. And in Basra, the problem was that you sent in Iraqi forces as a result of the prime minister's decisions with no planning, no support, no real screening even of the forces. One of the units that did most to desert was a newly formed unit with almost totally inexperienced personnel. We have to, though, be careful about Sadr. One of the problems we have is that the government Shiite coalition today is dominated by two parties, al-Dawa and what's called the Islamic Supreme Council in Iraq, or ISKI. These parties are headed by Maliki, who is associated with Dawa, much the smaller party, and the Hakim family, which is a traditional rival of Sadr in the south. They're also closely tied in the past to Iran and seen as more elitist. Sadr has been able, basically, to capitalize on the lack of any real Shiite political parties. And the problem isn't so much his Mahdi army, which doesn't have anything like the strength you're talking about, but the fact that he has populist support. The other two parties really don't reach out into the countryside, into the cities. They don't provide humanitarian services. They don't provide a welfare network. The Sadr party does. So there is a very serious risk of a Shiite power struggle in Iraq, unless these local and national elections can be held. And we need to see that as much more of a threat than the military threat from the Mahdi army, at least as it exists today.
Daniel, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you as we continue to talk with Anthony Cordesman, who is the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Ian is next in Madison. Ian, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions for you, Professor. First, regarding the U.S. interactions with Iran, it seems like the philosophy thus far has been confrontational, designed to demonstrate the U.S. Power and strength over Iran. Do you think, just sort of thinking of different possible approaches, do you think a more respectful approach at a more even level, trying to use discussions and accept their claim to the right to have arms and such would yield good results? And my second question is regarding airline safety. It seems to me this security around liquids, gels, and aerosols that all of us know quite well, it seems ineffective, seems to create a lot of waste, and so it's certainly a big bother to a lot of people, especially people with infants, for example. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were on how effective and how necessary those measures are.
Well, let me begin with Iran. I think that the United States would be much better off if it carried a big stick and spoke softly rather than spoke stickly and really didn't respond. We have really probably wasted the opportunity for a much more aggressive approach to dialogue with Iran under the Khatami government, which was, to some extent, a reform-oriented government. In fairness to the Clinton administration, however, they did make attempt after attempt. And what often happened was that we would come up to the edge of some kind of informal step forward, and because of the internal political problems in Iran, the Khatami government would have to back away. Now, what has happened since then is the election of a president who is associated with the hardline elements of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, who is religiously a hardliner, who is basically tied to one of the most extreme interpretations of Shiite faith. You've seen in the electoral process the virtual disenfranchisement, not of ordinary Iranian candidates, but of Iranian candidates which were allowed to run in previous elections. And what we have is a very hard-line, very opportunistic Iranian government. Now, should we talk to them? The answer is probably yes. Should we attempt to work with them? Again, the answer is yes, but it's important to note that we're actually trying to do this in Iraq right now, and that the meetings so far between the U.S., Iraqi, and Iranian representatives have not gone well, that the Iranians have often failed to show up. So we are not going to be dealing, either under this administration or the next administration, with an Iran where dialogue clearly produces quick or near-term benefits. As for the problem of airline liquids, I think that what you raise is a legitimate issue in that the types of liquid explosives that people are talking about are essentially ones which require much larger amounts to be effective than the limits currently being enforced. But without some kind of control on what people take on board, you would have fairly serious problems. So one of our difficulties is that we keep taking sort of an extreme look at every type of airline security issue based on the latest attempt or threat, rather than have a more balanced approach which might ease things. We also are very slow to fund, in some cases, the kind of X-ray machines which are critical to better safety, or to really train and retain adequate screening personnel. So yes, we have a problem. It is one where we haven't particularly well executed it, but it's not clear at the end of this the lines are going to be all that much shorter, even if we get the right plans and equipment.
Ian, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. The number for you in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. We're talking today with Anthony Cordesman, the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we'll take more of your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Kathleen will be back in the announcer's chair tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, so we'll be happy to have her with us. Right now, we continue to take your phone calls as we talk with Anthony Cordesman. And Brindley in Bristol is next. Hello, Brindley. Brindley? I'm sorry, we're not able to hear you, so we will go to Harold in Milwaukee next. Hello, Harold. Harold?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, this is Carl in Milwaukee.
We have it as Harold, but
oh,
we'll call
no,
you Carl.
Carl. And a little over 5 years ago, when we invaded Iraq, I couldn't believe my ears when I heard this, because the big concern and the big flap at that time was about 9/11. And I wanted to know, if we have to invade somebody, why aren't we didn't we invade Saudi Arabia, where the terrorists were trained and the Al-Qaeda cells were? Because this was really the source of the debacle and the fire that was poured down upon us. And instead, Saudi Arabia was completely sheltered. The Saudi nationals who were here were carefully cordoned off and provided safe exit from our country. And it was, and the media behaved as though Saudi Arabia wasn't even a consideration, when it was in Saudi Arabia where all the source of what we faced was occurring. And then at that point, we could have taken over the Saudi oil fields and secured the oil there. Iraq did absolutely nothing to us, and in fact, Saddam Hussein provided a very strong buttress against a much more serious enemy, which is Iran.
Well, let's go back to the reality. The cells in training did not occur in Saudi Arabia. They occurred in Afghanistan. They were organized in the United States and in Europe. In the successful attack, there were largely Saudis present. It's important to note that in the many attacks we intercepted earlier, particularly those crossing the Canadian border, people had attempted to use North Africans and use people from other Arab countries that have been trained by Al-Qaeda. One reason the Saudis succeeded was at that time they took advantage of the fact that Saudi visa and other regulations were being treated with much less care and attention. But in the years since that attack, it's been very clear where the training occurred, how they were organized, and they did not occur in Saudi Arabia. It's also important to note that in the years that have followed those attacks, not only have we cooperated with Saudi internal security and intelligence in counterterrorism, but Saudi Arabia has, since 2003, been conducting its own struggle against Al-Qaeda in the peninsula. And it's turned out that that organization was actually one of the weaker elements of Al-Qaeda, which has many global franchises and local cells. In practice, what actually happened was that there were raids in Saudi Arabia in 2003, and they've been dealing with their own Al-Qaeda threat ever since. So when we talk about what's happened, it's important to note Al-Qaeda is an organization which is many franchises and bases in some 60 countries, that its main headquarters has been moved from Afghanistan into the tribal areas in Pakistan, that while it is often associated with Saudi Arabia, much of its intellectual leadership actually comes from Egypt and North Africa, and that its membership and elites now include people from Central Asia, people operating in Southeast Asia, people operating in Europe, and people operating throughout the Arab and Islamic world.
Can you envision, though, a planning that might have gone on to invade Saudi Arabia back at the time of 9/11?
Well, I think the problem when you invade an innocent country which has 24 to 26 million people in it who are Muslims, and the United States goes in without any clear reason or pretext and then seizes the national resources from that country, one would have to wonder exactly what the reputation of the United States would be in the world and how we could possibly justify this to ourselves. And if we don't like the problems we have in Iraq today, which is not a major exporter, trying to secure oil exports in a country the size of Saudi Arabia that's this heavily populated, under conditions where we have no justification whatsoever for our operations, and have it export close to 10 million barrels of oil a day every day of the year, seems like a very impractical proposition.
Harold, thank you so much for bringing up the topic. We appreciate hearing from you. And we go to Chris in Sun Prairie next. Hello, Chris.
Hello, guys. First of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for having a radio station that takes on these issues and has informed guests like yourself. And thank you to both of you guys because I respect that. My question that I have for your guest is, what is his thoughts and concerns on with over the past few years, and as I see time marching forward, you're seeing more nations starting to nationalize their oil, which kind of, in a sense, seems to could put a kibosh on Western oil companies coming in and profitizing off of it. And my concern is earlier your guest had made a comment that with all the power struggles and all the issues that are going on and the violence and, you know, having to move oil through violent torn areas, that that's one of the major reasons why the cost of our oil has gone up. And I can't help but question, what about the sense that the dollar has gone down so far in value that, I mean, the cost of oil in the last decade has gone up 300% on a dollar basis, and on a euro basis, it's only like 150, 160, but on a gold basis, it's gone up 0%. So I can't help but wonder that a major player that we're dealing with is not so much the violence that, first of all, a country like the United States, when we go into these nations, and I'll take Angola, for instance, we go into these nations and we help develop their societies and their structure, but at the same time, we typically are the largest arms dealers to these nations as far as for protection that we say and as far as for advancing their societies. But then when you look at what's going on, most of these wars and these violent stuff that is coming out of these areas have to deal with us and have to deal with the arms that we're putting in there and the taking out of the resources. My other concern is when you look at 1980 when Russia was taking after Afghanistan, we developed CENTCOM to kind of oversee the Middle East area as far as their resources to protect our economy, because our economy is an oil-based economy and it needs the flow of oil in order for us to maintain. Well, just recently we've now created AFCOM, which is basically the military's headquarters in Africa to oversee the Africa resources. And I can't help but say, if we're going through these problems in the Middle East now that started over 30 years ago, 40 years ago, what are we going to see in Africa when we're already going up with these same issues against China? You see the SOC coming together between Russia, China, Tajikistan, and a few other nations. I can't think of them. And here we are right across the border from some of these other nations, and it's basically a major resource war on this global scale, and all nations have to fight to get their share of resources. So I don't see how an end can come of this, or by us putting a fake regime into office like we did in Iran, is going to support the people when, at the end of the day, we're after one thing and we tell one thing out of the side of our mouth and we do another. I don't understand how we can expect to hold nations to sterile moral standards when we can't even hold the same moral standards ourselves. And I just want to know what your thoughts are.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Well, first, I think you need to be very careful about your economics. We also need to remember that the cost of any given product in Europe throughout the EU is still significantly higher than it is in the United States, the problem being taxes, regardless of the dollar to euro conversion. But when we talk about the security of oil, we also need to remember that for all the problems that we've had to deal with in Iran and Iraq, for every day of every year, there has been an almost constant flow of most of the world's oil exports through the Strait of Hormuz and through the pipelines that go into the Red Sea and other areas. In spite of all the problems and tensions, CENTCOM has been able to secure the flow of 16 to 17 million barrels of oil a day out through the Strait of Hormuz alone, and there are significant pipelines going into other areas through Oman and Saudi Arabia. So the process has worked. We also have to remember that when we talk about the pressures on oil, the problems have not been security-driven, partly because of the success of a lot of our efforts. Again, we began this era at a time when Western companies and Western demand dominated the world oil markets. By the early 1970s, the major Western oil companies, which used to be called the Seven Sisters, had already lost control of any of the oil reserves and oil output in most of the developing countries in the world, including every single country in the Middle East. So this is nothing new, and it's a long-standing reality. What we have seen, however, is these countries steadily expand their export capabilities over time to meet demand. But when you look at any of the rise in Chinese or Asian energy demand, and now India, you see that there's about a 40% increase taking place in demand outside the United States and Europe. That's putting tremendous pressure on prices. Nothing we can do is going to secure us against that type of market pressure. And when we talk about market pressure, we're talking about a global commodity sold to everyone in the world, essentially at an auction level. Everybody basically has to pay the same price. How can we deal with this? Basically, only through major structural changes in our economy. Only through finding alternative sources of energy
as prices rise. For example, Canadian tar sands are now a basic source of oil and product coming into the United States. But we face a future in which these issues aren't going to go away. Oil isn't going to become more secure, either in the Gulf or other places, and we're not going to see, because of security reasons, prices drop.
Let me ask you about an email that we got from Dave in Menominee, Michigan. As we pull out of Iraq in the near future, not precipitously, but in an organized, responsible manner, do you think that Iraq will fall into a condition worse than what the Bush invasion has brought the Iraqis?
It's a good question, and historically one has to be very, very careful about saying that you can take a country that has been broken by some 35 years of Ba'ath and Saddam tyranny, by a period of war and economic impoverishment that began with the Iran War and Iraq War in 1980, that has been subjected to a U.S. invasion, which wasn't organized at least for the first 3 to 4 years to deal with the problems in Iraq, and say that it somehow is going to become a more stable government. But there are at least some signs of progress. You have watched at least some easing of the ethnic and sectarian tensions and conflicts. You have largely defeated al-Qaeda. You have so far seen Kurd and Arab avoid any kind of open violence, and you are beginning to see movement in the central government in Iraq to basically win support from the people, although it's very slow. But are the risks in this high, that the situation could remain very unstable, or the kinds of progress made and more democratic government could be reversed? The answer has to be yes. This is going to be a very difficult, very uncertain effort. And whether we can withdraw with some definition of success at this point is very much in question.
Marie sent us an email asking, what I cannot understand is if Iraq really is the central front on the global war on terror and really is the fight of our generation, why our strategy is to eventually turn this fight over to the newest, weakest, and least experienced military force on Earth. This seems to be a deliberate misframing of the issue on the part of this administration. If it really is that critical for us to be in Iraq, why aren't we throwing everything we can at this fight, including mobilizing the industrial sector, reinstitution of the draft, and et cetera?
Well, the fact is that the rhetoric being used is, frankly, ridiculous. This is not the center of al-Qaeda activity. The truth is there is still a serious problem with al-Qaeda in Iraq, but it is not an international movement as much as a local one. I think virtually any intelligence analyst, and this includes the Director of National Intelligence and the head of CIA, and their recent testimony puts the center of al-Qaeda activity in Pakistan and Afghanistan, but more than that, there's a movement which is affiliated with other groups in over 60 countries. We have used rhetoric carelessly. We also have not, frankly, gone to the American people and said, this is a complex problem. Many of our reasons for invading were not sustained by what we learned after it. But there are good strategic reasons to take a well-planned, positive effort in Iraq as long as it moves forward. There are also cases under which we have to leave. Instead, we've had far too much rhetoric, both by those who support the war and those who oppose it, without any real discussion of what would happen. We can't go on indefinitely staying the course, but it also doesn't help to have two candidates who call for withdrawal without any explanation of what would happen if we did it, or what national security posture would be needed once we did it.
And one other email from Jim, referring to your earlier comments about refunneling Iraqi money to pay for the Iraqi army. Under international law, the United States is obliged to keep society functioning and pay for the destruction that the invasion has wrought. Shouldn't we provide the basics with that money because the Iraqis suffer from the lack of running water and electricity and build up that side of the economy?
We have done this, and we've done it now for approximately 5 years. Let me note that under international law, our obligation to continue doing it expired in June of 2004 when sovereignty was restored to Iraq, which at that point, as a sovereign government, assumed again the responsibility for its own fiscal destiny. The difficulty now is that you have enough resources inside Iraq to handle a great many of its development and security problems.
And I'm afraid that we're going to have to leave it right there because the clock is striking 12. I'm sorry that we can't go any further. We've been talking with Anthony Cordesman, the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Our thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production, to Carmen Jackson for on-air production, Rhonda Fanning for producing the show. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network.